Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. We're here in the middle of March, a snowy weekend after a winter of no snow as we head into spring, get a little bit of some snow squalls. I don't know if we might call this herring snow or not, but looking towards the herring fishery to start here shortly, and definitely a lot of stuff moving around out there with birds and marine mammals and all those things that are attracted to herring. I want to thank folks who've taken the time to share some observations with me over the past couple of weeks. It's always fun to hear what's going on out there. And if you're seeing anything, I'd love to hear from you as well. SitkaNature@gmail.com if you want to send me an email, or you can get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page. You can also find links to recordings of past shows at SitkaNature.org/Raven. As we're moving into spring, we're definitely noticing more birds singing. I haven't noticed any songbird migrants yet. I imagine the gulls will start showing up if they haven't already. They tend to concentrate once longline season starts or the herring starts spawning. It seems like there's still wintering flocks of juncos and robins around, but I imagine they'll start to disperse here in the next 2 to 4 weeks, and we'll start seeing some of our first songbird migrants probably by the end of the month. Out on the water, things seem to be moving. I've been noticing more sea lions around along near shore and some whales out a little further when I've been watching. And it's the herring season. And every year around this time, the Sitka Whale Fest runs a fundraising cruise, the Food Web Cruise, they call it. And they look at herring and the place in the food system. And I've been invited on for several years now to speak about birds, and I'll be doing so again this year. Next Saturday, the 21st of March at 9 a.m., they are usually other experts as well to talk about marine mammals and then the human relationship with herring, both the modern fishery as well as the traditional uses from the native people here over many, many years. So that's a fun one to look for if you're interested in an opportunity to get out on the water and see what's going on. I'd like to introduce the conversation I have for this week's show. I spoke with Dennis Landwehr earlier this year. He was in town to give a talk as part of the Natural History Seminar Series on landslides. He's been studying landslides in Southeast Alaska for over 20 years now with the U.S. Forest Service out of Ketchikan. I was able to catch that talk and thought it would be interesting to speak with him for the radio show, so I appreciate his willingness to do so. I know I learned a lot from both the talk and from the conversation, and so I hope that in listening to this, you'll gain a better appreciation for the ground that's under our feet and the water that moves through it and how that moves and shapes our landscape. So without further ado, I'll go ahead and start the conversation. It seems like the big story is that we have a lot of rain and we don't have, you know, as many rivers and stuff as there is. It's not nearly as much as water is falling down. And I hadn't really ever thought about it before, but you mentioned like a lot of the alpine stuff where the highest levels of rain fall due to the, I guess it's called the orographic effect, where you get more rain higher up. It isn't actually surface runoff up there. There's very few streams. I mean, there's very little area of up there that actually drains off on the surface. I mean, you get the sort of channels and stuff, but I didn't really thought about that before. So that water's going somewhere, and that's kind of what's driving a lot of the landslides in the end.
Right. You know, in the alpine where there's bare bedrock, obviously we're getting some runoff there. But in the forest, where we have a thick duff layer, those soils have to process all of this rain that we receive in Southeast Alaska. So they do an incredible job of getting rid of that moisture and processing it somehow. There's very little surface runoff in the forested environment. Almost all the precipitation soaks into the soil and it has to go somewhere. And if it can't go somewhere, it's going to saturate the soil and cause landslides.
Yeah, so how does it, like, I mean, where is the water going? And I don't really think about it that much, or I hadn't really thought about it that much until this landslide, and I noticed, like, there's water just seeping out of where the cuts were and things like that, and that's pretty typical, I take it.
Right, our soils process all of this water in several different ways. First of all, most of our soils are relatively coarse textured. They don't have a lot of clay, which is one of the finer elements of the soil. So they have to process a lot of water. It soaks in, it runs down in sheets across impermeable layers like bedrocks, but that's all occurring under the soil. And sometimes these soils form soil pipes. In other words, the water finds a preferential flow path like a root channel that's going downslope, and the water concentrates there and actually erodes a cavity or a macropore, we call it, and creates a soil pipe, and those happen quite frequently in volcanic ash soils.
And so around Sitka in particular, we have we have a fair amount of volcanic ash, especially if you're on the right side of, I mean, I guess the volcano blew in a certain direction in north, maybe there's a little less volcanic ash, but right in town, there's these big banks of volcanic ash and so forth. And when you look at them, you know, you see these, there's layers in there, and I guess those correspond in some respects to different eruptions, but it sounded like, and this is something that I hadn't heard about before, but I think you called it the plaquic layers. And maybe those are forming between layers of ash where, like, I don't quite understand it, but it's like a deposit essentially of stuff that's precipitating out of the water.
Well, first, Sitka is the hotspot in Southeast Alaska for volcanic ash. Most of the rest of Southeast Alaska, we don't find volcanic ash soils. Mm-hmm. Most of those are weathered glacial till soils or soil that's developed directly from the rock. So Sitka is the hotspot for volcanic ash in Southeast Alaska, and we don't see these thick deposits of ash elsewhere. And the eruptions of Mount Edgecumbe and Crater Ridge, they weren't all one time. It wasn't a one-shot deal where it dumped a whole 6 feet of ash at one time. It dumped 2 feet in this eruption and then later another eruption. And there's some evidence in the soils, especially on Harbor Mountain, that there was some time in between these eruptions that allowed a soil to begin to develop, and then a second eruption buried that soil. So all of these different layers of ash, they don't all have the same permeability to water. So when water is soaking into the soil vertically, it's traveling down with gravity, and it hits a different layer, a layer with different permeability. It might be coarser, it might be finer textured, but it's going to slow down there until it reaches saturation before it soaks into that layer below it. So when it slows down at those points, the water is carrying organic matter and iron, which is pretty highly soluble material. And when it hits those layers and slows down, it begins to precipitate out organic matter and iron. And in some cases, a dense, hard, brittle layer called a plaquic horizon can form in these soils. And they can be another form of a sliding surface if you're on steep enough slopes and so forth.
And so I guess in terms of actual slide dynamics, you need some surface on which to slide, and then water is just kind of a mighty fine lubricant is what it seems to work out to be, like if there gets to be enough of it there.
Right, and water is extremely heavy.
Yeah. So
when the soil is saturated with water, it's much heavier than when it's not saturated with water, and it's a great lubricant, as you mentioned. And you have multiple sliding surfaces in Sitka. So you have dense glacial till, volcanic ash, and multiple layers of volcanic ash with different permeabilities, and you have bedrock.
And so, you know, just in terms of thinking, it seems like a lot of times when you see the landslide, they're mostly associated with these storm events, which involve a lot of water. But I also wondered about, like, Does it matter if it's windy? Like, does the wind? I could imagine that the wind moving the trees would kind of, translate into the roots kind of moving around, and maybe that sort of movement would break some things loose and help get it started. But maybe that doesn't matter in the end. Maybe the much bigger thing is just how much water is there.
Wind certainly has a role to play if it's windy and rainy. Mm-hmm. And trees are moving, certainly those roots are loosening up the soil. And you know, in an extreme event when the tree is actually tipped over, it's breaking roots and opening up the soil to direct inputs of rainfall. It no longer has that duff layer on the surface. So wind throw has been implicated as one of the contributing causes to landslides during storm events. But wind without rain, not likely to see very many slides.
Yeah. And so sort of the best or worst case, depending on how you look at it, I suppose, scenario for landslides is a lot of rain for an extended period, and that gets the soil saturated.
Mm-hmm.
And then this big rain event, which sort of oversaturates it, I guess.
Right.
And then that's when things start to cut loose.
And if you combine that big rain event with 80 or 90 mile an hour winds that are tipping trees over, that's yet another contributing factor. But these last several storms haven't been extremely windy, but a lot of rain. A lot of rain in the previous week and month.
Yeah. And so it's interesting to think about, I guess, in some ways, the soil is just like a big sponge. And, you know, it's always so wet here, it seems like, but I suppose the amount of water that it can hold, I mean, it's because it's also, you know, fairly, well, of course, where the landslides are happening, it's relatively, I mean, not like super steep, but it's definitely a slope. And so the water just under gravity is going to tend to want to flow through that. And I mean, is there any sense that I've always been curious, or since I've thought about this, been curious about how fast the water moves through, like how fast does it drain out? If it stops raining, how long does it take to sort of desaturate there just from gravity?
Permeabilities in soils, I'm thinking off the top of my head, I don't have the literature in front of me, but in sandy soils, you can have permeabilities of inches per hour, mm-hmm. so they can handle an awful lot of rain and not get saturated. In finer texture soils, your permeabilities drop to, you know, 10th of an inch per hour. So obviously when we're getting rain at the rate of an inch an hour or even half an inch an hour, those soils are going to saturate.
And then once it stops, then it just keeps flowing downhill. And that's kind of the, like when you see the river takes a little while to drop, that's all the water sort of pouring off the hillside.
Coming out of the soils and they need to dewater now as well. So the soils slow down this movement of water going down the hill.
Yeah.
So you're right. They kind of act like a big sponge.
Yeah. Okay. Except for when they get too heavy and oversaturated and they find it's a weak spot in sort of the friction that's holding everything up, essentially these sliding surfaces where either water gets in there or more water and then I suppose once it starts to break, then I guess if I remember my physics days, there's the coefficient of static friction and sliding friction, and once it starts to slide, it slides a lot easier. And right. So then it tends to like move. And is the release point, like, I don't really understand, I guess I hadn't really ever thought about the dynamics of these landslides. Would it start over a broad area and then all go at once, or is it just kind of like this sort of the, you know, you see in the cartoons or something, the crack that forms and then kind of, you know, juts out and then everything kind of goes once that crack gets far enough?
Right. Well, my experience in looking at these slides is it's again, like I described last night, it's like the pebble in the pond, and mm-hmm. it begins this ripple effect. So you're starting at one point is usually a concave surface. In other words, a curvilinear surface that's depressed, that's collecting water, and water becomes saturated there. The soil becomes saturated, and the weight overcomes the friction coefficient, as you said. And so it begins with like a teardrop shape and then comes down. But it's almost always the upper end of these slides are a semicircular mm-hmm. shape where it tore in a circular fashion.
Okay.
And then released downhill.
So it is kind of just a limited area usually where it starts. And then once it starts to entrain more. And I guess that was, you had a couple different shapes. If it stayed on the, non-glacial till stuff, it tended to just broaden out, which is
right.
what happened at Stargavin, it looked like. I mean, it's relatively narrow at the top, although it seemed like it was fairly wide across,
right.
and then got very wide at the bottom. And a couple of, there's actually a spot of kind of an island of trees in the middle that seemed to have, like it went around that for some reason.
Right. The Stargavin slide started on residual soil on bedrock. It took on this classic isosceles triangle shape.
Mm-hmm.
Most slides over bedrock form this classic triangular shape. And then about just below the first cliff, there's two big rock outcrops on the Stargavin mm-hmm. slide. V-notches bounded the slide on both sides at that point. If the slope would have been smooth, I think that slide would have been even larger, even wider on the bottom. But those notches tended to bound the edge of the slide and contain it. And the trees that survived within the slide zone are trees that were isolated on bedrock knobs, either high on the slide or on the lower part of the slide became channelized. As I said, it fell into these V notches and then it hit the main stem of Stargavin Creek and made almost a 90 degree turn and flowed down Stargavin Creek. So it was confined by the topography, the V notches that were there prior to the slide.
Yeah. So I'm curious. So when you've, have you just visited up there once? You got up there in December?
Yes, I've only been able to get to the top of Stargavin Slide. It was December. It was a short day. I didn't have a lot of time to look at the bottom of the slide. I was kind of intent on getting to the top where the initiation zone was.
And sort of understanding. So when you look at a slide, you want to see the top, and generally that's where everything starts. There are other slides where it could start differently, but our slides are typically...
Most of the slides on the Tongass, these water-saturated soil slides, are starting at the top, or the initiation zone is at the top of the slide, and the weight of the water is pushing down on the slope. There are some slides that start at the toe of the slope and work their way up. I gave examples last night of rotational failures often start that way. And these small slumps that we have on road cut banks and so forth are started because the toe of the slope is undercut. But most of our debris avalanche slides, as I described last night, the water-saturated conditions up on the hill slope, the bigger landslides that we see in southeast Alaska that are not rockfall slides, are saturated soil conditions, and they start at the top of the slide. There can be a little bit of head cutting above that, especially if the initial release of soil has torn the fabric of the root system above the slide. That may come down later.
Okay, so essentially, the slide happens, and then there's this oversteep cut, basically, where it all released, and then that basically collapses.
Can collapse sometimes. Yeah. It's not real common for it to collapse, but it can collapse sometimes. As I said, if the initial release was pulling on the roots and it tore in maybe two places at first, but then the second spot released quickly, that part that was torn with the original break could come down later.
Yeah, and presumably at that point there wouldn't be as much to pile up to entrain as it headed down.
Right.
And so it'd be a much smaller sort of event. And I guess that, so you mentioned there are several different kind of slides in your talk last night, but you just mentioned here, so you have rockfall, and that's one where, if you have cliffs or something, usually it's exposed rock, it sounds like, and then that falls, and then that provides the sort of breaking force to release the, it's not just a pure rock fall, but rather it that impact, presumably an extra weight, breaks the slope there, and then everything falls down. And so that's a different sort of start than what we've mostly been talking about so far, which is where it's just this slow accumulation relatively slow compared to a rock hitting it, of water and weight, and then it kind of falls down there. And so I'm trying to remember the name. So the rockfall one was when the rocks fall and hit and get it started. And then there's the, was it debris torrent? Is that?
A debris torrent is a slide that's confined to a V-notch some point or through most of its run.
Okay. And then what is it that they're called when it's like the Stargavin, for example?
Those are called debris avalanches, and when there's enough water present, which most of our debris avalanches have, it's also called a debris flow, but regionally, we just call them debris avalanches. Okay. We don't try to distinguish between flows and avalanche. Now, the rockfall-initiated slides like Redoubt Lake, they create a debris avalanche below the cliff when those big boulders calve off the cliff and they start wiping out trees and vegetation below. That's then considered a debris avalanche field as well.
Okay.
Just a non-saturated type of debris avalanche.
And so those ones don't... I mean, unless it happens to happen, unless it sort of coincidentally happens during a storm with a lot of water, those wouldn't necessarily be expected to have a lot of water in them.
Not necessarily saturated soil conditions.
Yeah, yeah. And so Stargavin in particular, part of what was interesting to me about going up there is sort of the runout zone, I guess, and it was fairly extensive. At the very lower end, well, before you even got to the obvious damage, there was... And obviously, there had been a lot of water that moved through there. And then there's this pile of small woody debris stuff just like where it had kind of been pinned up. And it's fairly high, so it was clear there had been a lot of water. And then you get to the log zone, and there's just, I don't know how, 100 yards or something of just this big stack of logs. It was kind of impressive. And then we walked around that and went up. And then the sides, it's just, there's this... they're not really walls, but these banks essentially of trees and mud, and very, it was, the mud was kind of in I don't, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, I just don't have a lot of experience, but it was very soft and kind of soupy, and you didn't really want to step in it because you could see that you would go pretty deep. And then in the middle, it was just gravel. I mean, it was clean, fresh-looking gravel. There was no mud at all. I mean, there was some logs or stumps or something in there, but it was mostly pretty clean. And then you walk up into the slide area, and it's, you know, of course, it's a very large slide, you know, to my mind. And most of it was still covered in mud. I mean, there was places where the, like, I guess there's probably the V-notches that it channeled into towards the end where the water was still then draining, and that had kind of cleaned off some of the mud and started to erode down into some of the other layers. But so, like, I was trying to imagine how this happens. And it, so as you said that it starts at the top and it gets going, and then, like, I mean, and obviously nobody was there to see it, but how fast would you expect that this came down the hill? I mean, do you have any sense of how that might have played out?
Right. This particular slide, because it was saturated soil conditions, we had a lot of large woody debris involved, a lot of trees, a lot of old growth timber involved. Still, it was probably moving at meters per second. So a very fast trip down the hill. You know, it's possible, and we don't see a lot of evidence of a slowdown or a damming effect when it hit Stargavin Creek. But certainly when it hit Stargavin Creek, it got a whole bunch more water added to it and became very fluid at that point. It was already fluid coming down the hill, but it had more water added to it from Stargavin Creek, and a very fluid, soupy condition. And it'll remain that way for, depending on the slide, you know, and the situation, they can dewater in a week or two. Certainly over the winter, those soils will dewater and it'll be much easier to walk on next year. The first day after the slide, those soils are so saturated with water, you don't really want to walk out there because you're going to be sinking very deeply, probably over the top of your extra tufts.
Yeah. And that's where, well, when I first looked, it was several days after, I think. But I could see the people who'd gone out there before, maybe it was the Forest Service people at first, I could see their boot prints that were quite deep, you know, at least calf deep. And that was just on the side. And I don't know, I didn't want to walk in the other stuff. So, it comes down the hill, and essentially, I guess as it starts to come down, it gets churned up. So what structure there is in the soil that kind of makes it seem solid, you know, the roots and the, you know, whatever else it is that's kind of holding it together. Once that kind of gets churned up, then it just becomes, I guess you described it as watery oatmeal sort of texture. It's like it's very loose, and then it hits the main channel. Because that was one of the other things that was interesting to me, is like it started way up there, and then but the sort of the wash up on the other side was actually not very high at all.
And that was a surprise to a lot of people, including me. But there is a small bench near the bottom of the slide that may have started to turn the slide. And it was becoming channelized at that time, so it was following the V-notches on both sides a little bit. So I think it was starting to turn even before it hit Stargavin Creek. That's the only thing I can figure out.
Yeah.
How it turned. But the woody debris and the trees in there, this slide, the large slide at Stargavin, and we have to remember there were four slides out there in this storm event. You know, there's 60 acres of trees in this slide, and you look at the debris pile and you look at the ends of the logs, they're all beat up.
Yeah.
They look like they've been pounded on with hammers, and they're just really beat up trees. They've been ground through the mixer coming down the hill, bouncing over the bedrock, bouncing into other logs, and really chewed up the ends of the logs. So there's probably some sediment embedded in the logs, but a very fluid mass. Early in my career, as I showed pictures last night, I had an opportunity to witness a landslide and walk through the debris pile within an hour of the slide occurring. And it was about thigh deep on me, which was about 3 feet deep. And again, the consistency of very, very loose oatmeal. This material was highly fluid, and that slide certainly traveled at meters per second, as I described. You know, there was a row of alders on the edge of the road, and 1 second it was there, and I never even, it was a blur crossing the road and gone. It was just a matter of that, and it was gone.
Wow. Yeah, and so I guess, like, I imagine, given the conditions at the time, Stargavin Creek was probably roaring, so as it started to come down there, there was probably already a lot of water that then just tended to, like, floating is not quite the right word, but basically there's plenty of lubrication and momentum from that water to start pushing stuff down. And I guess once it made that corner, it probably just circled around. And then I guess, so as it was going down in the sort of run out, there wasn't a lot there, you know, that was part of the clear cut zone. And so like a lot of alders were coming up. There's probably, on the sides, you can still see there's some larger second growth sort of spruce and stuff, especially at the lower end of the run out. But those alders, I guess, probably aren't very deeply rooted or strongly rooted. And so it just blew all of those out. But on the sides, I mean, that was part of the internet. It's like, and I think you were describing yesterday that part of what was going on there is that there was a lot more sort of resistance, friction on the sides, and so stuff hung up there. And I guess in some ways that probably helped channel the stuff in the middle because it didn't spread out as much that way. It sort of piled up and the stuff in the middle just kept going and then flushed down. And I guess so what must have cleaned the middle out was that after all the debris sort of flowed out, there was still a lot of water moving, and that just removed all that mud and stuff from the gravel.
Right. There's friction on the edge of the slide, and as the gradient reduced, we came off of the steep slope. We dropped onto a relatively gentle floodplain slope there. And so the woody debris started to hang up on the sides and collect on the sides. So we have two rows of woody debris down each side of the slide. The water and the mud continued to push on the middle of that pile and kept pushing and pushing and pushing until it finally ran out of energy due to lower gradient slopes and hung up on the ATV trail as its final resting place. So if the ATV trail and the bridge wouldn't have been there, it would have probably gone just a little further and distributed that wood out in a more spread out on the floodplain than it did. I mean, it's piled up pretty good right there.
Yeah, it is. It's an impressive pile. And I suppose I suppose that's probably not a super common occurrence to have that much wood pile up as a result of a landslide.
Well, this landslide's almost 60 acres in size, as near as we can tell from our GPS points out there and transcribing it into GIS. It's a very large Southeast Alaskan landslide. Typical landslides in Southeast Alaska, much smaller than that, you know, less than 10 acres in size, very, you know, much more common. That is a very large landslide. And so there was a lot of material involved. So we often see wood, and some other researchers, Di Johnson, has described when slides occur in old growth, there's usually a pile of woody debris at the very bottom of the slide that gets hung up and entrains sediment there. So, and that's what we see in this slide. Slides that occur in recent clear cuts don't have that woody debris, so they tend to just run out, and there you see sediment streaks flowing off into the forest.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting to think about, I guess, on the longer scale. This slide is kind of big by our standards, but it's probably not unusual for such a slide to happen somewhere, you know, every few hundred years, I would imagine, or something, where you get a, you know, big event, and you know, it's easy to kind of get focused on our human scale sort of things, where it's like the biggest one I've ever seen by far, But like these rare events that happen are big, and it's going to take a long time for that. Like if that wood is just left there, it's going to take a long time for that to rot, essentially. And so in the meantime, stuff's growing on top and sort of developing this other. And so I don't know if you have a sense of, there are places, I think you were talking a little bit, you showed a picture, an aerial photo of this, and I wasn't quite sure where it was, but this valley, and you could see the main channel running down the middle, and then there was these places where there was big, looked like, you know, probably big spruce trees or stuff, and they were all at the base of these sort of V notches where there would have been, you know, slides that had happened, and so then these debris piles would have been there. Like, is it something that there's been any research into, is looking at like the long term, like what happens with these piles of stuff, you know, what's the sort of lifespan of these, and I guess, you know, the succession essentially that happens with these landslides.
So very little woody debris has been dated from alluvial soils, floodplain soils. We've got, you know, old growth trees can be 500 to 1,000 years old. So When we date these trees, these logs buried in alluvial fans, we have to keep that in mind that, we get a radiocarbon date and it's 1,500 years old. Well, the tree may have been 500 years old when it fell. I recently did some work in one of our watersheds down on Prince of Wales. We augered into a log that was buried in a floodplain, and that log turned out to be over 4,000 years old, which surprised me that it survived that long in the soil. But the soil was moist, pretty much an anaerobic condition. You need aerobic conditions to break down wood rapidly. So that was a surprise.
I'm sort of curious as to what happens over the long run. So let's just, focusing on Stargavin, I guess what I imagine will happen is that there's alders there. So alders are pretty rapid colonizers, and they'll almost certainly, within a couple of years, there'll be dense alder seedlings along that lower, flatter stretch where it's all gravel now. And I don't know, maybe they'll also, there's a lot of mud. I imagine that churned up mud's probably going to be pretty good for vegetation, or things will like to grow in it, maybe.
Oh, yes.
But then there's the exposed outcrops of rock and so forth. And I suppose, in general, part of what must matter is how stable the slope remains. Like if it's just going to continue to sort of slough in a slow fashion, then vegetation can't really get started there very easily. And so, yeah, I'm just like, in general, we don't have fire here. So we have wind throw and these landslide events, which tend to turn over the forest a little bit. And so I didn't know, just wondered if you had some sense of like, once it happens, what happens after that? What's the sort of timeline and scale for those?
Well, the fate of the woody debris is going to depend somewhat on the stream. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to remain in a pile. It's exposed to air. The wood will decay eventually, and it'll be a mound out there in the forest floor. I would be very surprised if alders did not colonize the bottom of this slide, probably up to at least that first rock outcrop, and maybe beyond that. And then, of course, after alders are there for a period of years, spruce will come in underneath the alders eventually. If there was not an alder seed source, this slide would likely come back to spruce, but there are a lot of alders in the Stargavin Valley, so it's highly likely that it'll succeed to alders now and kind of a primary succession pathway back. The rock faces, leaves and detritus from adjacent conifers will eventually cover those. Lichens will occupy those rocks, and it doesn't take a whole lot of soil here because we have an abundant rainfall to get woody vegetation growing on those sites again. So I don't have a good handle on the time frame. 100 years, more or less, you're probably going to have something growing up there. Those rocks will be covered with moss probably in, 15, 20 years.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I guess I don't know. You mentioned that you guys are working on, there's a project, sounded like mostly through the Forest Service, but working on cataloging landslides in Southeast Alaska. And you'd said that there's maybe over 12,000 sort of in the database right now, more or less. Some of those being avalanche chute tracks, is mostly from remote sensing kind of
correct. We're using air photo imagery. We do add, when we have a storm event like we had last January on Prince of Wales, we'll add those landslides because we've got ground truth information, GPS points, and so forth to locate them. We actually used a float plane to fly. We have a remote sensing person on the forest that took pictures of them for us and georeferenced the pictures, and then we're able to get an accurate map built of those slides. But otherwise, we're using sets of aerial photo imagery, remote sensing to map these landslides. And as you said, there's over 12,000, and some of the compilers are adding the snow avalanche chutes because in many cases those have been historic slides in the past. Other compilers aren't compiling the snow avalanche chutes because around Sitka especially, there's so many of them and they're so large. They didn't think it would add to the database. But the way we have those landslides coded in the database, we can sort and attribute those slides. So when we do analysis, we don't include those snow avalanche areas.
Are you including just like sort of fresh avalanches there? Or are you trying to include older avalanches that where you can see the evidence of them, but they've started to grow back? Or, how does that work in terms of a historical perspective?
Right. That's a good question. And on the forest, you know, foresters have been using air photos to map vegetation and decide where the big trees are and where they want to log and so forth for many, many years. The earliest air photos on the Tongass date back to the 1920s and the 1940s when the Navy was looking for spruce trees to harvest to build airplanes for the war effort. Later, the Forest Service, because we were doing so much management of the vegetation, we had air photos flowing every 5 to 10 years. So we're using these historic data sets to map landslides, and we usually start with the most current data set that we have, and then we work backwards from there and try to find an age for every landslide that we see. So I know that there are landslides on the forest that some mappers have missed because they were all overgrown already and so forth, and those landslides are probably pushing 100 years old now, and you know, we're not going to catch all the landslides. So we're using the data sets that we have. We try to date the landslide to when it occurred. So if it occurred between this set of air photos and this set of air photos, we have an attribute for that and try to date the landslide so that we have some idea of what's occurring, when and where. And if we ever want to do a frequency analysis of how many landslides are occurring in this type of landform or this land type, we can go and say, okay, to do a frequency analysis, we need a time frame, because frequency is expressed as landslides per unit area per time. So we want to be able to do that analysis eventually. But right now, we've pretty much covered most of the forest with at least one set of air photos and looked at it for landslides. We're adding new landslides as they occur, but we obviously don't get them all. Just last month, we had a big storm event in Ketchikan, 10 inches of rain in 2 days after 30 days of 37 inches of rain, I think it was. So we know there's new landslides, but we haven't gotten out yet to compile them. We haven't been out flying around. Pilots haven't been telling us about them, so they're not in the database.
Yeah. And are these primarily then a forest? Because I'm reminded there was a big, I guess it was a rockfall one up And it was large enough that I'm trying to remember the stories, like that the more sensitive seismic detectors actually like noticed it essentially, and then somebody went out and flew. I'm thinking it's like it was above Glacier Bay and this big La Perouse, maybe. I'm trying to remember.
Oh, yes.
And it just ran out down the glacier. Of course, you know, nobody's anywhere near there at the time that it happens, but somebody flew over and looked at it. But are you trying to map? So there are in Southeast Alaska and kind of the mountainous ice and rock regions, landslides that occur. Are you trying to map those ones as well, or just
we have not been? You know, our priority was to inventory areas where we do a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really. I guess when I look at the gaps in our landslide coverage, it's typically the ice fields. We just haven't mapped there, and probably a very low priority for us to try and map landslides in the ice fields.
Yeah.
So those parts of the forest, both on the Yakutat Ranger District and the Juneau Ranger District, are gaps in our forest-wide coverage. So the 12,000 landslides you mentioned is primarily in our work areas, the Outer Islands and Misty Fjords. So,
do you, I guess you said that one of the things you'd like to do is kind of start to understand the differential frequencies for I suppose, important sort of broader scale elements would include maybe aspect, because the direction that the water's coming, I mean, the rain tends to come from a certain direction, the wind tends to be blowing a certain direction, and so maybe that makes those facing slopes more prone to slide. Underlying geology, I imagine, makes a pretty big difference.
Yes.
Obviously, topography makes a difference. And so outer coast versus inside waters, those kind of things tend to make a difference as well? Do you have a sense of that?
Oh, absolutely. We haven't done that type of analysis yet, but certainly karst terrain, for example, because all the water is moving vertically and it's soaking into the bedrock and finding other flow paths to the ocean. in karst terrain, there's very few landslides unless they're associated with a till-filled sinkhole or a till slope that was left out there by the glaciers. But in a well-developed karst area, very few landslides. So to be able to separate those type of areas from the different rock types, as we mentioned last night, the Kelp Bay group of rocks that sits well behind town here versus the Sitka Gray Wacky that's in town. We'd like to be able to tease out those differences a little bit and say, hey, here's a difference in landslide prone terrain, and be able to map that and catalog that a little better than we've been able to in the past. Currently, the forest has a slope stability classification based on soil map units, and our soil mapping is relatively coarse scale on the forest. I think we can do better with our regional geology and landform mapping that we're currently working on. So
I'm just curious about the soil stuff, which I remember, I guess that's when I first met you. You were in town working on some of the soil classification mapping, trying to refine that a little bit from what it had been or the previous sort of work there. What is it like? You mentioned that at the top of the landslide at Stargavin, I think you said it was a residual soil, which you explained in your talk was weathered, essentially weathered rock. And so and then whatever organic stuff basically grew and kind of mixed in there.
The top of the Stargavin landslide is a residual soil that's only about 6 inches thick over bedrock. Over the top of that residual soil laid about 3 feet of colluvial soil.
Oh, okay.
Soil that came down the slope by gravity and was deposited over the top of that slope. So a residual soil can actually develop underneath the colluvial soil. It doesn't have to be exposed to air. It's exposed to air through the soil because the soil is full of pores that can carry both water and air. So there's gas exchange in the soil. So a residual soil quite often forms underneath another soil, especially a non-saturated, well-aerated soil like we saw at the top of the Stargavin slide.
So just, I'm not sure I understand quite how this works in practice. Basically, the rock is kind of, it's dissolving. It's not really dissolving, disintegrating kind of.
Correct.
And breaking down through the action of water and freezing, or it probably isn't freezing it that deep, but water and maybe some of the stuff is dissolving as the water moves through and leaving other parts. And so is it kind of like, is it sort of a sandy texture or
Right. It depends on the rock type. Okay. I mean, if the rock yields fine, if it's a fine textured rock, you'll get fine textured sediments. A sandstone rock is going to yield sandy sediments. Mm-hmm. Most of our rocks in Southeast Alaska are yielding very silty sediments. So when you think about glacial silt coming out of the glaciers, a lot of our soils have a high volume of silt in them because it's the soils, many of our soils are ground up bedrock that's been laid down and that till is weathered and the soil has developed in it through the action of water percolation, through vegetation growing in it, through bacteria in the soil and other critters living in the soil that interact and chemical reactions go on and liberate nutrients and elements like iron and create organic matter and organic acids from the organic matter then contributes to the acidity of the soil and the development and the breakdown of these primary minerals that come from the rock. So
I guess, and as I'm listening to you, I'm realizing I'm not quite sure that I know what makes it soil as opposed to say sand and gravel and maybe I don't know if there's a clean or clear definition of what makes something soil as opposed to not soil, but is there?
Well, you're testing me now. Going back to my school days, soil has to be capable, I think, of supporting vegetation. So if it's capable of supporting vegetation, then it's classified as soil. I'm thinking that's the definition, but this is a hard one for me because I'm not remembering very well. But so a bare parent material like glacial drift, if it's not compacted, seeds land on it from adjacent forest or whatever, and pollen lands on it, and organic matter detritus from trees land on it, and it starts to build from there. So, yeah. And as it builds, then as it gets vegetation on it, so there's five soil forming factors, and I'm going to try to remember these, but it's topography, slope, vegetation, the parent material, and time, I guess. I think I got five of them there, but I'm not sure. So soils take time to develop and yeah. grow, and they change through time as they grow. So
part of the work of, you know, if somebody's specifically focusing on soils, it's part of that work is just classifying sort of based on those factors, presumably, you know, the age, I guess soils go through aging process and so forth. And that makes sense. I imagine it's a fairly complex thing because it seems like that can be fairly complicated in terms of all the different factors that can go in. But in the end, you basically, if you can dig holes in it, kind of, so to speak, then you're looking at whatever you can determine out of the...
We look a lot at the horizontation of the mm-hmm. soil, and that tells us a lot about the age of the soil, and we do chemical tests. The pH is a relatively simple chemical test. If we need more complicated chemical tests, we send the soil away for lab analyses. We do textural tests on the soil, some just by hand feeling the soil, and others, again, by sending it away to a laboratory or doing the separation ourselves through sieving the soil. Just looking at the horizontation can tell us a lot about the soil. On the Tongass, first let me back up. The soil scientists classify soils based on this big, thick book called Soil Taxonomy. Mm-hmm. And soil taxonomy is a language all its own. So it's a relatively complicated book, but we start out with 12 orders of soil, and we work our way down to families of soil and so forth, similar to taxonomy of plants or animals. Mm-hmm. So on the Tongass, we have basically four of the soil orders are represented here, the very young soils called entosols, the slightly older soils called inceptosols, and then we have spodosols, which are typical forested soils that are well-developed soils that translocate iron and organic matter, and then organic soils, the histosols. So those are the four main soil orders on the Tongass, and we classify from there down. Thus far, soil scientists have documented, I believe it's right around 100 and some different soil series, we call them. So these are unique individual soils. And beyond that, we have map units of soils, which then break up those series into different slope classes, different landform positions, and so forth. And there's 750 approximately soil map units that we've identified on the forest so far.
Yeah. So, and then this all goes kind of into GIS, and you look in the long run, kind of looking to understand just the distribution of those, and then how they interact with other things like vegetation or
correct. Soil productivity is a big concern for us, especially as the Tongass begins to transition to young growth management. We need to understand the productivity of those sites. How quickly are they going to be able to grow trees to harvest, since we have a pretty limited young growth land base? So soil productivity is an important interpretation for us. Slope stability is another important interpretation for us. And then the other thing we do, because we're mapping landforms out there, the soil maps are also used in our riparian habitat models. We've mapped out the alluvial soils, so that those polygons are included in addition to stream channel buffers based on stream channel type. And stream channel type and stream process group is driven primarily by landform. So the two go hand in hand. But the soil scientists have mapped out the polygons, defining those riparian areas along streams. Those are added to the mandatory buffers that our forest plan requires for the channel type that's out there.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's one of the things, you know, you mentioned that the slope stability analysis thing, and what occurred to me is, so if this basically bedrock can be weathering underneath, And I guess this is kind of related to the question that you addressed a little bit during your talk, which is like, why now? You know, essentially, why does this suddenly, this has been stable for a long time. What happens? And you mentioned a couple of things like diversion of water via various means or, collapse of those soil tubes that you talked about. But I'm wondering if I could imagine that some bedrock might weather in a way that essentially isn't very sticky, for lack of a better word. Like you get a layer of something that actually, once it gets thick enough, just very easily slides on itself.
Right.
And that could be a potential, a source or reason for it to cut loose. Because I didn't really thought about that these are actually, and I guess this is sort of naive on my part because it makes sense when you explain it, but that bedrock's actually what I think of bedrock as weathering when it's in the weather, but even when it's buried, it's actually still
as long as, again, under anaerobic conditions, it's not going to weather very much. Mm-hmm. And we see that in our dense till all the time. You think that we've got this soil there, right? It's just been compacted by a glacier, but as long as it's away from oxygen, there's not a lot of bacteria that can operate in that environment and weather that material. And especially if it's in a saturated soil condition, it's underwater. Again, anaerobic soil conditions, meaning no oxygen. If it's exposed to air, then bacteria and other critters can get at it and start working on it, and water can, and we have plenty of water, we have plenty of soil moisture. So the bacteria and so forth can start to work on that soil. The organic acids from the vegetation can start to work on that bedrock and chip away at it and create soil. And that's what we saw at the top of the Stargaven landslide, was a soil formed from this kelp bay group of rocks, which includes a lot of calcium, a lot of fine textures, and some serpentine in there, which makes for a pretty slick sliding surface.
Yeah. So those are actually going to tend to, because of the glacial till compacted issue, you'll tend to find those then higher up on the slope then around here.
The residual soils?
Yeah, the residual soils.
Yeah, the residual soils, because many of the valley bottoms, I suppose, are covered with glacial till. Again, on the mainland, glacial till is not spread equally across all the valley bottoms.
Right.
The north half of Prince of Wales has a lot of glacial till soils. The south half doesn't have very many. The mainland, all the glacial till on the mainland is probably in the bottom of the fjords.
Yeah.
It's not up on the exposed mountain slopes. So we see a lot of bedrock soils, very little till mapped over there on the mainland. So, but you're correct. The residual soils we more commonly find up on the more gently sloping upper hill slopes where they haven't eroded away.
Yeah.
And then developing often under alluvial soil or some other soil.
Yeah.
But they're still getting air.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to think about all these processes. Like I hadn't really given much thought to where, I knew glaciers deposit a lot of stuff. You have your glacial moraines and all of this stuff. And of course, anywhere that somebody digs around here, you see the volcanic ash, and there's the organic layer on top of that, and then sometimes fairly thick layers of volcanic ash, and then it's sometimes underneath that is bedrock, but sometimes it's this glacial till, which I guess is this compact, seems to be basically unsorted and very compacted. It's very hard, it seems like. And then, that's usually on top of bedrock, it seems like. Although I suppose in some places it could be pretty deep. There's all these, the movement of water and air is that... and then time is there's a lot going on, it seems like, below the surface, and it's interesting to think about just like over the long term how much difference that makes. And I don't like, do you have a sense of like sort of the time scales involved with, like you mentioned that there's young soils and then slightly older soils, like is this on the order of tens of years or hundreds of years or thousands of years that these are developing? Or
Some work that's been done on the outwash and the glacial till deposits in front of the Mendenhall Glacier, easy access, you can go out there and study soils. And in other parts of the world, in sandy soils, you can get a very weak, thin spodic development in like 200 years. More commonly, it's on the century and millennium timescale. Certainly we see a lot of spodosols in our forested soils here because of the amount of rainfall and the vegetation that we get. Materials move rapidly. Iron and so forth is released and moved rapidly through the soil. But we still have entosols close to the glaciers and inceptosols on younger soils closer to the glaciers, you know, time zero being the glacier pulls back and exposes some soil. So on the forest, I think it's highly variable. I've always wanted to try and figure out soil age if we could find stable sites working from the outer coast, the southern part of the forest, up toward Juneau. And there should be an age gradient there from when the ice pulled back and exposed these soils. So that would be an interesting study to try to do, is figure out the ages of these soils, get carbon dates and so forth, and try to figure out if the soils down there are actually older than the soils near Juneau and closer to the ice field. And in theory, they should be.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose that's complicated a little bit by the changing sea level, is finding the right spots to...
Changing sea level and, of course, the disturbance regime. Mm-hmm. Wind throw can disrupt soil horizontation and mix up all these soil materials and set back the clock, so to speak. So yeah, disturbance plays a huge role in it.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just a fantasy to try to figure this all out and sort it out.
Yeah, it would be like, it's easy to just not realize, you know, you just sort of think about, you know, it, for your lifetime, it's mostly the same. But then every once in a while, you have these events like the Stargavin slide, where it's like, oh, well, you know, stuff is going on. I don't see it that often. How often is this happening somewhere? Probably every year, there's a pretty good sized slide somewhere, I imagine. But most of them, I mean, unless you're out there looking for them, I guess most of them you just don't really notice.
Right. We live in a pretty remote and wild land, and we don't see every inch of the 16 million acre Tongass every year. So there's a lot of things that pass by without being noticed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I should let you go here. We've been talking for about an hour. So I just wondered if you had anything else that you wanted to mention before we wrap up.
Oh, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to talk to you this morning. It's been fun.
Oh, great. Yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed your talk last evening, and there's a lot of people there, so I think there's a lot of interest in landslides, and I guess, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, now I'm curious about them. I'll try and pay more attention to soils, and you know, when you have the opportunities, I guess the cut bank, you know, most of us probably don't carry around shovels and dig holes in the woods, but, you know, when somebody digs a trench somewhere, you know, take a look and try and understand what that's telling us about those places. Are there any sort of, like, you know, new person or neophytes guides to soils or something that you know of or that would be worth looking at, some sort of resource?
Oh, there's the classic book called Forest Soils by William Pritchard, I believe, is a typical textbook at the college level.
Mm-hmm.
As far as a soil primer, I think the NRCS, if you go to their website, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, they have some nice educational materials for all the way from school children age up into high school age. So that'd be a good place to look for educational materials on soils.
Well, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Sitka Nature Show and a conversation I recorded with Dennis Landwehr of the U.S. Forest Service. He was in town earlier this year to give a talk on landslides, so I appreciate him taking the time to visit with me while he was here. And thanks to you all for taking the time to listen to the show this week. As always, I appreciate the reports and everything that folks send in about things they're seeing. A lot of stuff starting to move as we're getting into the springtime of year. By the next show in a couple of weeks, we'll be into official spring, so looking forward to that. And want to remind folks that there is the Whale Fest Food Web Cruise. I've been helping out with that to talk about birds for the last several years. I always enjoy that opportunity. And so if you're interested, you might check that out. Happens next Saturday morning at 9 a.m. So you can send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page. You can find links to past recordings of our prior shows at sitkanature.org/raven. Feel free to share what you're seeing if you have questions or just curiosity or just want to share. I'm always interested to hear what's going on out there. So thanks for joining me again this week. This has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW Sitka.